Turn now to the Lord's Word. The scripture lesson for our sermon this morning is Genesis chapter 31. This is the Lord's inspired Word. It is therefore inerrant. It's a rather lengthy reading as we go through the whole chapter here. This is one pretty well encapsulated portion of the account of Jacob's life. So we'll take the whole chapter together. The sermon will be a little lengthy as well, but Lord willing, it will be edifying to his people. So let's attend with reverence to Genesis chapter 31. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all this wealth. And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock, and said to them, I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all my might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said, thus the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream. And behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray spotted. Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob. And I said, here I am. And he said, lift your eyes now and see, all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family. Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. Then Jacob arose and set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock, which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, and that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river and headed toward the mountains of Gilead. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. Then he took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. The God had come to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said to him, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword? Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me, for I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp? And you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. And now you have surely gone because You greatly long for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban went into Jacob's tents, into Leah's tents, and into the two maids' tents, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household gods, put them in the camel's saddle, and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me. And he searched, but did not find the household idols. Then Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. And Laban answered and said to Laban, what is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all my things, what part of your household things have you found? Set it here before my brethren, before your brethren, that they may judge between us both. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was in the day of the drought. In the day, drought consumed me, and in the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. And Laban answered and said to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and this flock is my flock. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? Now, therefore, come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap. And they ate there on the heap. Laban called it Yeger Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore, its name was called Galeed. Also Mizpah, because he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. Then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap, and here is this pillar, which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, that I will not pass between this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread, and they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning Laban arose and kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. And thus ends the reading of God's holy word for us at this time. May he bless its reading, its exposition, and its hearing. Well, last time we saw how the Lord had prospered Jacob through Jacob's hard work and God's blessing. Jacob's wages from the flocks of the sheep and the goats were multiplied. And he had even been able to trade in this wealth to gain other things, because his wealth, of course, was goats and sheep, but he gained servants and camels and donkeys, we're told. And so Genesis 30, verse 43 declares, thus the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Though he had dealt honestly with Laban under the terms of the agreement, as he says to his wives in verse 6 of today's reading, "And you know that with all my might I have served your father." He didn't shirk in his work whatsoever. And though Laban had not dealt honestly, Laban and his sons are the ones who become jealous of Jacob's prosperity. This must have prompted Jacob to begin to think that he needed to get away. He needs to get away from Laban and from Laban's household. And at that point, the Lord speaks then to Jacob and tells him that it's time for him to return to Canaan. He commands him to return to the land. Chapter 31 tells of these things and of Jacob's journey toward Canaan. And today I want us to make our way through that account, as we've just read, and we'll consider, as I recap the account here, first, what are some problems with Laban's character that are revealed in this account? You may have noticed some. Secondly, the fact that the Lord was with Jacob as he had promised. And third, we'll note the covenant that's made between Jacob and Laban. And through this all, we'll see the faithfulness of God demonstrated. So let's consider Moses' account. In chapter 31 begins with Jacob's hearing that Laban's sons are saying of him, "Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all this wealth." Now, is that quite the case? We saw last time that's not really the case. Both of them have flocks that are growing. It just happens to be that the best are the ones that meet the criteria to be Jacob's, and that's both by Jacob's skill and by God's blessing. But what we see here really is this kind of jealousy of the prosperity of others that we see on the part of Laban's sons is really a common human failing. If you haven't noticed it, you probably haven't watched or read any news in the last several decades. Because we hear it today all the time in the words of those who claim that maybe somebody who's a bit wealthier than the rest of us couldn't possibly have that wealth unless he had exploited someone else. We hear it in the words of those who say that nations like the United States can only be prosperous because we're ruining the rest of the world. We've stolen our wealth from other nations. We hear it in the rhetoric of those who claim that those who are wealthy don't pay their quote-unquote fair share, even if they're taxed at a much higher rate than people who have less income. So those views often come from an assumption that Laban's sons seem to share. It also comes, of course, from covetousness. But it comes from an assumption that wealth is kind of like a pie. So if we are ever able, Lord willing, to have a shared dish meal again here at church, maybe you can imagine someone bringing a pie, and I, being the glutton that I am, go up there and I take a whole quarter of that pie. I take one-fourth of that pie for myself. Well, that only leaves three-fourths of the pie for the rest of you to divide among yourselves. Now, if one person takes a bigger piece, that leaves less to be divided between everyone else, right? But as we recognized last time, that's not usually how wealth works in the world. You may have noticed, if you've read any history, that those of us who aren't considered very wealthy in our society today are very wealthy compared to our ancestors. And depending on how you measure wealth, you could say that every one of us in this room is wealthier than Queen Victoria. She didn't have an air conditioner. She didn't have a smartphone. She had all those servants and spent a lot of her wealth trying to make her life a little more comfortable, because she didn't have the things that we take for granted that make our lives comfortable. Jacob had not become richer while Laban had become poorer, which is pretty much the accusation here. Both had become richer. Now, obviously, his daughters in the same passage recognize, Laban's daughters do, Jacob's wives, that they say that God has taken his wealth away and given it to us. That would only be in terms of the fact that Jacob's part of the flock grew stronger and faster. But both of them are actually growing. Both have become wealthier than they used to be. The flocks of both have grown. Jacob's wealth had simply increased a little bit faster because of his hard work on the one hand and God's blessing on the other. And this is why we ought to be really wary, by the way, in our own day when we hear political rhetoric, people talking about income gaps. Be cautious when you hear someone say that an income gap is a problem. There have been times and places when the rich have gotten richer while the poor have gotten poorer. That does happen. God's word would condemn such a thing, certainly if it's done by exploitation. And that usually we find actually happens in tightly controlled economies. You'll notice in the books of the prophets, if you read about this sort of thing in the Old Testament, the exploitation of the poor usually comes hand in hand with a corrupt government that's controlling them too much and favoring the wealthy over them. However, usually in a freer economy, when the economy is healthy, most everyone tends to grow in wealth. Now, if everyone is prospering at the same time, one person may get wealthier faster than another. And so that means if we both start off at about the same level, but I get wealthier faster than you, well, the gap between us is increasing, but we're still better off, both of us, than we used to be. Doesn't mean one is getting poorer. I'm just not getting wealthy at the same rate. There isn't necessarily any injustice in that, though we recognize that whether an economy is free or not, human beings are still sinners, and people will still exploit whatever situation they're in and take advantage of others. That happens. That's not the fault necessarily of the economic system. It's the fault of sin. Laban's sons, however, betray this usual motive behind those kinds of complaints. He's taken our wealth from us. They're jealous of Jacob's prosperity. They want it for themselves. And I don't think they would be complaining. I would venture to guess they wouldn't be complaining if the shoe were on the other foot, if it was their wealth that had been growing while Jacob's hadn't. They've inherited their father's covetousness, it seems. They were no doubt hinting their wicked accusations in Laban's direction, for he no longer looked with favor on Jacob. Jacob observes this. He could tell. And so he must at this point have been thinking, now is probably a good time to slip away if I can. And of course, the Lord then speaks to him. Verse 3, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. So he has the promise, the assurance from God that if you do this now, I will be with you. And likely remembering how Laban had tricked him before, connived again and again, and had talked him into staying when he wanted to leave before, Jacob decides he'd better leave secretively. And so he calls Rachel and Leah out to the field where he has his flocks to discuss this. So the most obvious reason for this is so no one else can overhear what they're talking about and word won't get back to Laban. He says, I see your father's countenance. It's just a fancy word for facial expression. The look of his face. I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. He goes on, again we see the kind of maturing that we noticed last time too on Jacob's part. He's noticing how God has been with him. And he goes on to point out that though he's worked hard, he's worked fairly and honestly, he's given all of his strength to the job which he should have done. We should give our strength to the job that we are called to do. He's done this honestly for his father-in-law. Though he's done that, Laban has tried to change the deal repeatedly. He says 10 times, and maybe it's exactly 10 times, or that could just be a figure of speech, meaning several times. In any case, over and over again, Laban has tried to change the deal. But each time, whether Jacob's wages were now to be just the speckled, or they were to be the streaked, or they were to be the spotted, or whatever, whichever animals were to be his wages, those are the ones that were born. Now we see that this is the kind of thing that couldn't have been manipulated very much by Jacob. We noted last time that he could have noticed which ones of the solid colored animals were nevertheless going to bear offspring that were streaked or spotted when they bred together, and made that happen, or helped to make that happen, increase the likelihood anyway. But now it doesn't matter whether it's just the spotted or just the speckled or just the streaked. That's what's going to be born. Now we see clearly God's hand in this. And Jacob's wealth thus grew faster than that of his father-in-law. The Lord had even spoken to Jacob in a dream to explain that he was the one intervening to make this happen. Notice an interesting thing in that dream, that it's again the angel of God in verse 11 who speaks to Jacob. But then this angel says in verse 13, "I am the God of Bethel. I'm the God you saw before in your dream, where you anointed the pillar, where you made a vow to me." So once again, here we see the Lord, Yahweh, coming as his own messenger, a person sent by the Lord who also is the Lord at the same time. So we see again that the notion of multiple personhood in the Godhead is not something brand new in the New Testament. And we've reasoned this out before to see that this must be God the Son. So he was the one who had appeared to Jacob in his dream at Bethel. He is the one who is Jacob's ladder, Jesus Christ, before his incarnation, on whom, as he told Nathanael, "You will see the angels ascending and descending." His reference to Bethel, reminds Jacob of his promise to be with him, to bring him back to that land, and of Jacob's vow to worship him when he does so. But Rachel and Leah, when Jacob talks about this and tells them what's going on, they agree it's a good idea to leave. And they speak, in fact, bitterly. This shows again how tragic the family situation is. They speak bitterly, it seems, about their father. In verse 14 through 16, they say, "Is there any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him?" That makes you wonder how often he actually spent time with them after their marriage. "For he has sold us," they say, and also completely consumed our money. "For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it." We see here, by the way, a practical lesson that a wise man will seek the counsel of his wife and not go forward with any major plans without talking them through with her. And Jacob sees the wisdom of that. But what Rachel and Leah say is really telling. It's really informative to us. They believe that their father has treated them like property, selling them for Jacob's labor. You might recall when we dealt with Jacob's marriages that that's not really always what was going on in these situations. Some people today would like us to believe that women went around with price tags hanging from their ears, that people could, or that men could purchase them from their fathers like they were chattel or something, like they were slaves, and that's not the way it worked. The custom of the time was for an exchange to happen. The bride's family usually received what was often called a bride price, but that doesn't mean she was a mere commodity to be sold. These were gifts that acknowledged that the bride's family was giving up something precious and valuable when their daughter was going away, and she would join another household. At the same time, she would bring with her, usually what was customarily known as a dowry, gifts from her father's household, in lieu of the inheritance that she was giving up by leaving that household. And it appears that other than the maidservants Zilpah and Bilhah that were given to Leah and Rachel respectively, Laban had given no dowry. Instead, he had apparently squandered any wealth that he had that should have been given with them. The indication we have is that Laban's household was not nearly as well off as his father's household had been by the time that Jacob married Leah and Rachel. So he had squandered what should have been theirs. And at the same time, for the other end of the exchange, he had nevertheless accepted 7 years each of labor from Jacob for each of these women. Without a dowry, it was as if Leah and Rachel had been mere property to be bought and sold. And they acknowledged that God has rectified this injustice, though their father treated them like mere property. God didn't let him get away with it and gave them their dowries, so to speak, by Jacob's wealth being built up from Laban's flocks. So with his wives in agreement, Jacob prepares to leave. He waits until Laban is busy sheep shearing. And he packs up his family. And remember, providentially, Laban has kind of set up a situation in which this can happen because he's keeping his flocks 3 days' journey distance from Jacob's. So Jacob waits until Laban's busy with the sheep shearing, packs up his family and his belongings, rounds up his livestock, and sets out toward Canaan. Meanwhile, Moses tells us Rachel has stolen the household idols that were her father's. Well, what's going on there? What a disturbing thought. Laban, who acknowledges the Lord as Abraham's, as Jacob's grandfather's God, and seems to be talking about the same God when he speaks of his own grandfather's, Abraham's brother, Nahor's God, and says he's the God of their great-grandfather, Terah. Someone who would have knowledge of the Lord like that would have idols in his house. The Hebrew word here is not the common word for just an image. It's the word teraphim. Teraphim. T-E-R-E-P-H-I-M, as we transliterate it into English usually. What are these? Well, Ezekiel 21, verse 21 says, "For the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the road, at the fork of the two roads, to use divination." So by the way, the more modern practice in the occult of going down to the crossroads, as the old song says, to do some occult activity, not a new thing. The king of Babylon in Ezekiel's day was doing it. Went down to the crossroads, went to the fork of the road to use divination. He shakes the arrows, he consults the images, he looks at the liver. So divination refers to a ritual or magical practice that's designed to gain knowledge supernaturally. So instead of gaining knowledge by going and seeing or doing an experiment or reading a book, you're trying to gain it supernaturally without God revealing it to you. So we're talking about things like crystal balls and that sort of thing. Apparently, shaking arrows had some means of doing this. We do know of ancient practices of shaking up arrows in the quiver and dropping them on the ground, perhaps, and seeing what pattern they fall in. Looking at the liver, sacrificing an animal, looking at its liver to see what the auspices of the day. That's something that was carried forward even to the time of the ancient Romans. They were still doing it. But what are these images he consults? It's the same word, teraphim. So teraphim appear to have been used in divination. So think of astrology or tarot cards or crystal gazing in our own day. Those are forms of divination. And it's something that the Lord forbids. One form of divination involves consulting or attempting to consult the spirits of the dead. Of course, we know it's appointed for man once to die and then comes judgment. So unless the Lord intervenes and sends someone like Moses, came back and spoke to Jesus, the transfiguration after his death, unless the Lord intervenes, the spirits of the dead don't come back. And if people think they are, either they're imagining it or it's demonic activity. So what's going on here when people are trying to consult the dead? Well, the weightier evidence from history and archaeology is that these teraphim, these images, were actually used for consulting the honored ancestors of the household. They were images essentially that represented your ancestors. And it seems that Laban was succumbing to the pagan culture around him. That goes a long way to explain his worldliness, his reasoning, and his dealings with Jacob. As we saw in James earlier, to be a friend of the world is to be the enemy of God. And it seems like Laban is being more friendly with the world here. So why would Rachel steal these things? Well, it could be that she herself was attached to the idolatry she'd grown up with in her father's house. But there's another likely reason that makes sense in light of what she and Leah have already said about their dowries, about their inheritance from their father's house. To possess the teraphim, the household gods, as it's translated here, was to have a claim on the inheritance and the headship of the household. Taking Laban's teraphim was a way of saying, Dad squandered my wealth, but I'm going to take these in their place. Perhaps she took them in place of the dowry that she would have received. And if they were made of silver or gold, they could have been extremely valuable. Well, when Laban finds out that they're gone, he pursues with an armed force. We surmise that because he refers to the power he has to destroy Jacob, he's got a sizable group of men with him here. And he's likely further angered, as we see in his accusation against Jacob, that his teraphim are missing. And remember, again, he put this 3-day journey between his flocks and Jacob's, so it shouldn't surprise us then that it's on the third day that he hears that Jacob is gone. And so he pursues and he catches up to Jacob 7 days later. So Jacob's been on the road for 10 in the hill country of Gilead, east of the Sea of Galilee. And he might have harmed Jacob, but God speaks to him in a dream saying, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Now, that's a figure of speech. It doesn't mean don't talk to him, and it doesn't mean you can't say anything like, hey, I think you stole my teraphim. That would be bad, right? It's a way of saying, don't give him any trouble. Don't you dare start a fight with him. So instead, he merely scolds Jacob for leaving unannounced, not allowing him to send him away with a feast, say goodbye to his daughters and grandchildren. Of course, Jacob probably rightly thinks that he wouldn't have let me go if I'd said. But he says, Laban says, he could harm Jacob, but God has told him not to. But then he does accuse Jacob of stealing his household gods. Now, disturbingly here, this is probably the most disturbing part of this, is that he doesn't use the term teraphim when he says, my household gods there, in verse 30. But rather, he uses the same word that he used for God, the God who spoke to him in his dream. In other words, in his mind, these idols in his house are not mere symbols of the inheritance of his house. We might hope that that's the case, right? That he's just using the cultural practice of having this emblem of the inheritance of his house and maybe passing them on to a favorite son will be a way to say, he'll be the head of the household after me or something like that. But no, he actually thinks they're gods. Jacob answers the first question in verse 31, because I was afraid, you know, why didn't you tell me you were leaving and I could have sent you away and kissed my grandkids and my daughters? Because I was afraid, for I said perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. Then he answered about the teraphim, clearly not knowing that his beloved Rachel had taken them. And he says, with whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. That's not the ordinary penalty for theft, but it's a way of his saying, I'm so sure nobody in my camp has them, kill whoever you find. Well, as we reason from verse 33, that we see that it says after being in Leah's tent, he searched Rachel's. We see he searches Jacob's and Leah's tent. And so probably seems that he searches Jacob's, he searches Leah's tent, he searches the servants' tents, probably the rest of the camp too. But after going into Leah's tent, he'd gone into Rachel's. She's hidden the teraphim in her camel saddle and is sitting on it and claims that she can't get up, for the way of women is with me, she says. Laban thus does not find the teraphim in her tent, and after that he searches probably the tents of the other servants and finds that they're not there, so far as he can find. Well, Jacob is at this point incensed at what he considers to be a false accusation. He's angry also that Laban has chased him. He's angry that Laban has connived and cheated him for 20 years now. And so he says, "You've cheated me over and over again. I didn't tell you I was leaving because I figured you would have cheated me again and left me empty-handed." Laban still insists that Jacob's property is really his. You notice how he doesn't really have a change of heart here or anything. Even Jacob's family is his. He says, "But what can I do? God told me not to touch you." So they make a covenant, setting up a heap of stones to commemorate the event, as was the custom in ancient times, memorial pillars. You can actually find just aerial photographs of this territory. You'll find these things all over the place. Memorial pillars, piles of stones, even altars that would be erected to remind future generations of some binding covenant between two groups of people. This heap is called Yegers HaHadutha in Aramaic. It means heap of witness in Laban's language. In Hebrew, it's Galid. Hebrew and Aramaic are very closely related, almost mutually intelligible, but not. It takes a little bit of schooling on the part of one or the other, but not much. Some experience, and you could pick it up if you were a Hebrew speaker. You could, if you were around Aramaic speakers, it'd be a lot easier for you to pick up and say Greek or something like that. Nevertheless, over time, the common term, common way of saying heap of witness was quite different at this point. So Yegers HaHadutha is the way you would say heap of witness in Aramaic. In Hebrew, you would just say Galid, Galed, which also means heap of witness. It will be the symbolic border between Syria, between the land of the Arameans, and Israel. Laban also calls it Mizpah, which means watchtower, saying, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. If you afflict my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. If you mistreat them, if you marry other women, anything, God will witness." Now, Laban is right that God witnesses our oaths. He witnesses our covenants. We are accountable to him. But isn't it ever the way of cheaters and connivers to assume that someone else is going to cheat and connive against them? Jacob has worked honorably for him, but he says, but he acts as if Jacob's just the kind of guy who's going to mistreat his wives and do all kinds of terrible things. We've seen that Jacob's been greatly matured over the years. Maybe when he was younger, he might have been a little less trustworthy, but he's proved himself trustworthy to Laban. The content of the covenant is found in verses 52 and 53. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. Those are Laban's words. Probably for clarity, since Laban seems pretty spiritually confused here. Is he talking about the same God or different gods? Jacob just swears by the fear of Isaac. That could also be rendered the awesome one of Isaac. The Lord who had caused Isaac to tremble when he realized what had happened when Jacob had deceived him. And that God in his providence had caused his will to come about. After the appropriate sacrifices, there was a feast, and Laban kissed his daughters and grandchildren in the morning and went home. So what do we see here? We see some problems with Laban's character, obviously, as we've made our way through that account. Verse 1 and 2, we see he's envious of Jacob and unjust in his assessment of him. In verses 5 through 7, we see he is a cheater and a conniver still. In verses 15 and 16, we find that he has squandered what should have belonged to his daughters and otherwise mistreated them. Treated them like strangers, they said. In verse 19 and 30, we see that he is idolatrous. These are not things to emulate. Oftentimes people have this overly simple idea that people in the Bible are all good somehow. I remember hearing about a website in which people were some New Agers were sort of promoting talking to the dead, like the godly King Saul did in the Old Testament. Of course, King Saul is not presented as godly in that scenario in the least in the Bible. He's not wise, he's rebellious. Laban is not someone to look to as a character model. These are not things to emulate. These are things to learn not to be like. But we should always be examining ourselves and not thinking, oh, Laban was like that, but I can't be like that. We should ever be examining ourselves to make sure that we are not behaving in these ways. Through this passage, we also see that God is with Jacob. And so we see a major theme of Genesis shining through, the faithfulness of the Lord to keep his word. In verse 3, he speaks to Jacob and reiterates that promise. In verse 7 through 9, we see that he intervenes to prosper Jacob even when Laban was trying to cheat him again. In verses 10 through 13, he graciously shows in this dream what he was doing for Jacob. In verse 24, he warns Laban, don't harm Jacob. In verse 42, Jacob says, unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you, Laban, would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. God, again, intervening. And in verses 43 through 55, he providentially brings a settlement covenant between Jacob and Laban. And the covenant was one that promised that neither Jacob nor Laban would cross that boundary in hostility against the other. They can cross it, just not for harm. So the overarching theme we see here is that the Lord is one who governs these events, that he is a God who can be trusted, that he keeps his word, that he is sovereign, he's able to keep his word, and he is also faithful to keep his word. What a God we worship. What a God we can indeed trust. Let's pray. Well, Lord, we do thank you for your faithfulness, that you are a God who can be trusted, that you keep your word. Grant that we might grow in our trust of you, rejoicing that you are with us and rejecting that which does not reflect your holiness, holding fast to all that does. For we pray in the name of the perfectly righteous one, Jesus Christ. Amen.